Well, I want to thank all of you for letting me leave the class right after class last week. I did make it to the airport in time and got to Winnipeg. And the temperature there was the same as it is here, 28. It was 28 Fahrenheit there and 28 centigrade here. So, and they said it was the first winter on record where they had no snow in April. Usually the snow sticks around until May, but this year there wasn't any snow on the ground at all. So quite amazing. But I was grateful because it's the only time I've been to Winnipeg where it hasn't been January or February. So 28 felt really nice compared to minus 28 centigrade. So, but I was doing TV shows there on the book A Matter of Days. And we did, the hosts were so excited that instead of doing four 10-minute shows, we did six 10-minute shows. So. And it's a program that gets aired all across Canada and into the northern U.S. as well. And they're also very enthusiastic about Reasons to Believe. They've actually had every one of our scholars come up and do TV programming for them. So, good opportunity.
Will we get a chance to do that?
They will be available, but it was taped. So they insist that it air live, or it air first before they make them available. But yeah, we'll have an opportunity to see that. So. And yes, it was rather a bit of a shock to discover that in this cruise we're taking, they're going to celebrate my 70th birthday. Never realized I was quite that old. But I got reminded of that yesterday when I, you know, every morning I kind of do a fast walk or run. I used to run all the time, but my hip joints won't permit that anymore. But I was going up this hill and then past these, it was about 12 ladies. And one of them asked me how old I was. So I told them how old I was, and the other one said, pay up. Apparently they had bet that this guy that was smoking them was twice as old as they were. So now I realize, yeah, I guess I really am that old. But I'll tell you, as I was sharing with Warren here, I'm actually working harder now in my life than I've ever worked any time in my life. I mean, the Lord has just been giving me energy to do that. So, and I still got a lot more books I want to write, so... please pray that my health will hold up, because when it doesn't, I'll have to step back.
Were you on Prager a week ago or so?
I was on Dennis Prager's show. And yeah, I mean, that was, I've known Dennis for 30 years. He used to have me on this show called Religion on the Line. Interesting show. I think he should revive it, because it was, here's Dennis Prager. He teaches at the Jewish University in West Hollywood. And every year he teaches a class on the Torah, the first five books of the Bible. But he used to have this show called Religion on the Line, where it would be a Protestant minister, a Roman Catholic priest, and a Jewish rabbi, and he would moderate as an Orthodox Jew. And he was reminiscing with me. He says, yeah, I can't remember how many shows we did where everybody was on the liberal side except you and me. So, says, thank you for helping me deal with all these people who I can't even understand why they would even want to be men of the cloth, given the theology that they held. But what's exciting about Dennis is that, number one, he's impressed how well we evangelical Protestants know the Tanakh, that's their word for the Old Testament, and how well we know the Torah, for that matter. And we were talking about Genesis. And also, we were talking about the book A Matter of Days. And he's getting more and more excited about the ministry of Reasons to Believe. And that excitement really showed. He says, you know, usually I ask questions I think the audience wants to hear, but he says, in this show, I'm asking my own questions. So, anyway, we'll see what develops from that. And he gave me his latest book on the Ten Commandments. And a good title, it's called Ten Commandments, Still the Best Moral Code. So I appreciate that. I haven't read it yet, but it should be an easy read. It's a small book, and the lettering is such that probably within a few minutes you can read the whole book. So I'll have to do that sometime. They're keeping me too busy at Reasons to Believe.
He also has a Reader's Digest version on Prager University.
Yeah.
Yeah,
videos with it. That's what he's doing now. The original line.
Right.
Prager
well.
University, which is videos.
If I get a long grocery line stand, I'll read the book. So, but I wanted to bring a scientific discovery to you that's actually relevant to what we're studying in Proverbs chapter 30. Let me go into that text first, and I'll talk about the discovery, and then I want to get some feedback from all of you on how to apply this text. Proverbs 30, and it's the last text in Proverbs that we'll be studying on this, because what we're doing is going through all the texts in the Bible that have major content on the doctrine of creation. And what you see in Proverbs 30 is these mysteries of creation. You know, it begins in verse 4. Who's gone up to heaven and come down? Who has gathered up the wind in the hollow of his hands? Who has wrapped up the waters in his cloak? Who has established all the ends of the earth? What is the name and the name of his son? Tell me if you know. Making the point that there's these mysteries in creation that testify there must be a God. Elsewhere in the book of Proverbs says, only the fool says there is no God. By the way, that word for fool is a one who is in rebellion against the authority of God. It's not one who's, quote, stupid or anything, but someone who's in a state of rebellion against the authority of God. But it's making the whole point that it's the mysteries of creation that really tell us there must be a God that's responsible for all this. Then it gives us three examples. I'll only get to the one that we're actually dealing with that's relevant to this discovery. My pages are sticking together. It tells me this Bible is probably getting a little old. There are three things that are too amazing for me, four that I do not understand. And again, these are mysteries that tell us there must be the God of the Bible is responsible for this. The way of an eagle in the sky. And those of you who have been with us, recall how we talked about what's unique about the eagle that defies an explanation outside of the direct handiwork of God. The way of a snake on the rock, the way of a ship on the high seas, and the way of a man with a maiden. And I'm told you I'm stuck in that fourth one, mainly because I'm on the autistic spectrum. I really don't realize or recognize. In fact, it's amazing I'm even married, given my handicaps. So I'm asking for some feedback from you. But then this paper was published in Science that I found quite interesting, especially since we've been a year ago looking at what Job had to say. And the title of the paper is Oxytocin Gaze Positive Loop and the Coevolution of Human-Dog Bonds.
Wow.
So, quite a title, eh? Well, it's making the point that there's something special about dogs, especially as we've bred dogs over the past several hundred years, that actually stimulates the production of a particular hormone in the brain of both the dog and of the human being. And it's this hormone called oxytocin. I may not be pronouncing it right. Maybe some expert here can help me with it. But it's called the love hormone or the bonding hormone. And where it's most expressed, where you see the strongest expression, is when a woman gives birth to a child. There is a powerful release of oxytocin, which basically is designed to stimulate the bond between the mother and the child. But what this research study indicates is that when a human has a pet dog, there is a staring phenomenon that goes on. And that's what's unusual about dogs. They'll actually look us in the eye. And so, we're motivated to look the dog in the eye. You know, cats don't do this, but dogs do, right? And they'll actually hold our gaze. But what this experiment was pointing out is when that gaze takes place, it actually stimulates the production of oxytocin in both the dog and the human. And they actually measured it. They actually measured the urine release from the dog and the human and actually saw that this oxytocin actually did indeed increase. And it was actually a positive loop. The more the human and the dog have this mutual gaze going on, the greater the release of oxytocin in both the dog and the human being. Yes.
And isn't it the opposite of that, where you have negative feedback effects, or say other predators?
Okay. The paper also addressed that. They said when you look at wolves, which are not domesticated, undomesticated wolves, and there's a difference. There are wolves that you can actually make pets out of, and then there's wolves that are quote undomesticated. But the undomesticated wolf will not look you in the eye. And there's no oxytocin release that's going on there until, quote, the wolf is domesticated. But what they also is pointing out is that this has been a factor in the way we humans have bred dogs. wanting them to be good pets. We've actually, without even thinking about it, have bred the dogs to more and more as time goes on to have this mutual gaze with us human beings, which has actually allowed the oxytocin release to increase the bonding. And he says that's what we're actually suggesting, is that over the past several hundred years, because of how we bred dogs, the bonding, the emotional bond between humans and dogs has gotten stronger and stronger and stronger over the years. And they actually see that in all breeds. And so they're basically saying this is what's causing it. But as I go back to this text here, and by the way, several other things they've noticed is that the oxytocin release calms aggressive behavior. And so, for example, there's certain dogs, what's that famous dog breed that tends to be aggressive? Pit bulls. Right. With pit bulls, if you actually bond with a pit bull and have this mutual gaze going on, the aggressive behavior of the pit bull significantly subsides. And also the aggressive behavior of the dog owner significantly goes down. Yes. Right, yeah.
That, I don't know if men believe
that. No, it's both men and women, and so it's there. And yes, that kind of gives you some insight as to why the Bible says what it does about sexual relationships. It's to be between one man and one woman after they've made a marriage bond with one another. And it's because of the fact that there's going to be this oxytocin release, and it's got consequences. There's going to be a bonding that takes place there. And so this research paper is talking about dogs, but there's application with human beings too, that when we have mutual gaze with one another, this is what happens. Right. So, all right. It says, the way of a ship on the high seas and the way of a man with a maiden. And one thing I remember reading about this paper, I was sharing this with some of our staff at Reasons to Believe, and this one gal says, yeah, a woman friend of mine has a policy. She never dates a man that doesn't love dogs. And so, okay, maybe there's something to with this, because men who have this bonding relationship with the dog are going to be less aggressive. They're going to be more likely to bond and more likely to express love. So there's actually some insight in this. And actually, I think there's some insight as to why God gave us these animals that can form these strong emotional bonds with us. It's actually a powerful way to ameliorate human behavior along godly lines. And again, I can go back to the idea that here in the 21st century, for the first time, the majority of human beings live in cities. And the majority of human beings live in cities that are so crowded and so limited in terms of vegetation and the animals that people don't have these kinds of relationships that they used to have. And maybe this explains why behavior is more aggressive, why we have more atheists, why we have more agnostics. They simply are not having these bonding experiences with these animals.
Dude, that sounds like another experiment to see how many atheists own dogs.
Right. Well, well, I've been called on this when I've mentioned this in some of my outreach events, because sometimes an atheist will say, hey, I was raised on a farm. But yeah, did you ever milk the cows? And the whole point is there will be exceptions, but there is a trend line in the sense that it is true that you have a much higher percentage of atheists living in cities, and especially crowded cities, than you do, say, out in the farm. And even people in our farms, some of the farms, the kinds of relationships you have with the animals are not like what it was when you had mixed farms, say, 1,000 years ago. So I would say, yeah, there is a general trend, but be careful. There's always the exception.
Hitler loved his dogs.
Yeah, Hitler loved his dogs.
Really
helped him. Killed him with cyanide.
Right.
Okay.
Well, maybe Hitler didn't engage in gazing, mutual gazing with his dogs. That could be the problem. So, yes.
I just read this. It's like a bombshell. Hitler Did that guy in the war, he died in 1963, he ended up in Argentina, and he had two daughters, now Fender.
Yeah, there's been rumors for a long time. That must be a new one. I haven't heard that one. I'd be highly skeptical that he, quote, somehow survived the war, went to Argentina, and lived till 1963, because there's well-documented medical records that he was in the late stages of Parkinson's disease at the end of the war. So given the medical technology we had at the time, I don't think there's any way he could have made it to 1963. The doctors are basically telling him he had 3 years maximum to live, which I think explains why he was so reckless in the last year of the war. I mean, because you notice, once you go from, say, January 44 forward, the behavior of Hitler really changes, and he becomes much more reckless. Well, I mean, yeah, you could see his Parkinson's, but the decisions he made became much more reckless once he realized, hey, I'm not going to live much longer anyway. So, and I don't know about his dogs, so that'd be another good thing to study. So, yes?
I think it's also important to note that Hitler became dependent upon amphetamine injections that his doctor gave him. So he was basically an amphetamine addict, and his poor judgment was probably related partly to that.
So yeah, it could have been,
his
right.
His generals would advise against him, and he'd say, no, go, don't retreat, just so everybody gets on.
Well, I read one of the books put up by one of his generals, and in one sense, it really is the handiwork of God that Hitler became so irrational in the last year of his life, because basically what his generals were telling him was, you give us control of how to manage the war, and we can prevent the Russians from advancing. And likewise, the war could have probably gone on another 2 or 3 years. But because of the really terrible decisions that Hitler made in the last year of his life, where he overruled the better judgment and wisdom of the generals, the war ended much more quickly.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and I saw a documentary, and it said that Hitler did not... Oh, it'll come to me in a minute. I waited too long.
Gee, you're probably past the age of 39. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Before I forget.
Thank you. Maybe we need to recruit some younger people for this class. Go
ahead. Senior moments turn into senior minutes, please. Another book, a writer says, it was also, he is near miraculous. That says something in itself. That a megalomaniac like Hitler faced this greater and greater insurmountable opposition and growing amphetamine habit would force him into greater megalomania and greater amphetamine habit, which is a vicious cycle, getting only 1 or 2 hours sleep every 2 or 3 days, into where this guy has a new psych and a new neuropsychobiology. The emotions coming up would just be fiercer and crazier and out to lunch. I'm paraphrasing, but basically, it was quite. It adds now that God allowed that, allowed the end to come in his own way, and what he wanted, the insanity of I will be God.
I remember.
Okay.
Before it goes,
Churchill had plenty of opportunities towards the end of the war to assassinate Hitler. He was an easy target. He didn't want to assassinate him. He wanted him left alive because of his poor decision making. And it actually helped end the war.
Right. Yeah, that is true. But Winston Churchill, he realized the value not letting the war be continued by the generals. Having Hitler in charge is actually to the advantage of the Allies. So, yeah.
Can I make a request that the food people be asked to place their drink in food with oxytocin?
Well, that's an interesting suggestion. Another suggestion we could bring, maybe we need to bring some pets here into the class, because that would stimulate the oxytocin with probably a lot less controversy and debate in the class. But then the class wouldn't be as interesting, right? So. There you go.
Just remember, Hitler killed his dog with cyanide.
That's true. Yeah.
Oh, what kind of love is that?
What kind of love is that? So that's why I'm saying he probably wasn't engaged in mutual gazing with his dogs as he should have been. So.
I thought he shot himself.
He did shoot himself.
Yeah.
Because he saw his dog suffer, so he didn't want to go that way.
Right. Anyway, I'm back to the point of the text here. The way of a ship on the high seas, the way of a man with a maiden, making the point that God did create these animals first. He created them before he created us. And that God actually, notice what he did with Adam. Before he introduced Adam to Eve, he had Adam relate to all the soulish animals. These are the animals that are capable of emotionally bonding with human beings. And in that sense, there's a prescription, I think, there for how a man should relate to a maiden, is that, you know, the animals can be a pathway for making that happen, just like it was with Adam. He developed these relationships with these animals, each one bonded with him in a different way. I'm sure there was oxytocin release going on, which helped him get ready for this Eve that God had brought to him. And I'm just saying, based on what I see in this paper here, there may be an example there for us as parents. I think it's a good idea that we introduce our children to animals. And by the way, for people who live in cities, often what happens is that the parents take their children to the zoo. It's not quite the same. There's, you know, glass or a cage there, and the animal's pacing back and forth. The animal's not gazing at people. The relationship isn't there. What we really need to do is provide for our children, in the sense of getting them ready for marriage, where they actually can have relationships with the soulish animals, where there is going to be this oxytocin release. It's good for the animals. It's also good for the human beings. And maybe that explains why these higher animals are so motivated to come to us. You know, I've written about this in my book, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job, that we're in a place where animals have never seen human beings. They seem to be naturally drawn to us. And maybe they just recognize that by relating to us, they're going to benefit in the sense that that oxytocin is going to help them in relating to members of their own species. So, and I think you actually see that with our pets, is it actually helps them to relate to other animals. I think there's a TV show out there where it actually shows these soulish animals having bonded relationships with members that are not part of their own species. But you notice about that show, there's always a human factor. It's rare. It does happen, by the way, where a wild predator, for example, will bond to a wild herbivore. But the only time they've seen it where there hasn't been a human contact is, for example, where a mother lion loses her cub. The cub gets killed when the cub is very young. That's when the oxytocin is powerfully, because it's the same thing with the other animals. Just like when a woman gives birth to a child, there's a very powerful release of oxytocin that also happens, say, with cows, dogs, horses, lions, when they give birth to the young. There's a powerful release of oxytocin, which is all there to facilitate the bonding. By the way, it's also important to get the milk released from the mammary glands. Without the oxytocin pulse, that's not going to happen. And so, for example, when a mother lion loses her cub at the time when that oxytocin release is very powerful, and say there's a baby lamb or some baby gazelle, that mother lion will bond to the baby gazelle. That's if, of course, the mother gazelle also got killed. So there's actually been situations where they've seen that, where here's this baby gazelle that's lost its mother, here's the lion that's lost its cub, and the mother lion will bond with the... Now, the bond is temporary until the oxytocin wears off, but you'll actually see that mother lion caring for that baby gazelle as if it was her own. Yes?
One comment, one question. There was a story about a tortoise and a baby hippo who bonded to one another. Wherever one went, the other one went, they were inseparable, which is sort of funny. But, question, how about like a conure?
Pardon me?
Like we have a conure, you know.
Right.
Could the same thing apply there? They give plenty of eye contact.
Well, they do. But what I was going to make the point is that you actually see species to species bonding where the human is bonded to both. So So, for example, if you've got a pet bird and a pet dog, by having that mutual gazing going on between you and the bird and you and the dog, that can actually enable a bond to take place between the dog and the bird. And so this TV show, which talks about the Wallies cross-species bonding, inevitably, with rare exception, there's the human factor where the human is bonded to both, and this facilitates the two, and like a dog and a baby deer bonding, or a dog and a cheetah bonding. It takes that mutual relationship with a human being to make that happen. So, but again, back to this text, I think there's something beneficial in we human beings having these bonded relationships with the higher animals that actually facilitates our relationships with one another. So maybe a prescription to lower conflict between unions and corporations and between nations and wars. Let's have a lot more bonded relationships with animals. Yes, in the back.
You know, like if you're, I never had a kid, but you're having this kid and you're like responsible and you, this thing takes over you. Do you think that could happen, like the oxytocin, like in a hero, somebody who can go to save somebody or something? Do you think that might be released, like in heroes?
Well, there is a protective element in the oxytocin, but there's also an anti-aggression element. And so the two might balance one another off. I mean, what's most evident in the hormone is the way that it facilitates bonding and the way it facilitates a committed love relationship between the two individuals, whether it be a human and an animal, or a human and another human being, or an animal and another member of their species, or where they're bonded to a human being. It can be a member of one species and a member of a different species. So the oxytocin is a factor there, but it's... They says it has a lot to do with the eyes as to how that facilitates. And by the way, I noticed that with both of my sons when they were born. They immediately gazed directly into my eyes. And so there just seems to be a strong motivation, even on newborns. Yes?
Just want to, this is kind of a common question. If you can elaborate, I'd be happy to hear anything. I believe there's about 21 neural hormones brain, you know, maybe many more, but these that are actually feedback loops and direct sensory input and things like that. Where her question was, does it with aggressive people, well, you've got the different hormones for aggression, you know, and also things like, let me get past the senior moment again. I'm thinking of like endorphins. I'm more generalized, and there's more of them. And I know oxytocin is the affection drug, it's known as the affection, but endorphins are also a general release for anything we like, right? So, how compare and contrast oxytocin and endorphins?
Well, you're making a good point. This point was made in this article as well, is that when it comes to humans, we have by far the most complex assortment of different neural hormones that are operating. And so they said this is one of the difficulties of the research, was to come up with an experiment where they could isolate the oxytocin from the other hormones because it's complex. But it's something I've shared here in terms of the endomorphins. They've done experiments where those are released when people are actually out in beautiful scenery. So it's something about being around beautiful natural scenery that releases that. And by the way, they've also done research that shows when people look up at the stars, there's a release of those endomorphins. And so take a moment to look up at the stars. But again, you can see the problem with people living in cities. If you live in a city, looking up at the stars, not much there to see. You can see maybe two or three and that's it.
I remember being on the verge of crying after a week in Yosemite for the stars and everything, coming back and smelling the smog 100 miles out. This was 25 years ago in the stars.
Right.
Almost fine.
Yeah.
Big city, one.
Well, as I've shared here in the class before, I would take these Caltech atheist scientists up into the Sierras, and they'd be willing to talk about spiritual things. Never would happen on the Caltech campus, but it would happen up there. Because the stars are out there, natural beauty. It just, you know, that stimulates the hormones, and it gets people willing to talk and discuss things. Yes?
I've heard that near a waterfall, the falling water... causes more ions in the air. Is that true, and does that have an effect on you?
Yeah, it probably does. I mean, people love waterfalls, right? And yeah, you do get a lot more ozone being produced with a waterfall. You know, the principle is that if you're in a place, you don't know whether the water's safe to drink. If you've got a waterfall where the water's pounding down at a good clip, that will actually kill the bacteria in the water. So if you grab the water at the bottom, you'll be okay. But it might also explain why people like waterfalls, you know, because the ozone's going to have an impact on you as well. So, and by the way, what I'm writing in a book that's going to be released next year is that we happen to be living in that one era of human history where we got the greatest number of waterfalls. I mean, look at the past 4.5 billion years of the history of the Earth. It really is the past 10,000 years where we've had the greatest number and greatest height of waterfalls. It has a practical application. It means we've got the greatest potential for hydroelectric power. But you're raising a point that also means we've got the greatest potential for wonderful scenic experiences because of the fact we live at a time in the geological history of the Earth where we have such a great abundance of waterfalls, and the waterfalls are really spectacular. How do we know this? It's because we're following right after the most intense of all the ice ages in the ice age cycle. This is what generates this hyper, this superabundance of waterfalls. Yes.
In humans, the left side of the pupil communicates with the right brain, both pupils, at a 6 cycle per second, recognizing somebody's glad to be with them, that they're loved. So is that the same for the animals? Would they have that same type of connection?
I don't know. There has been some research that what's unique about humans in terms of mutual gaze relationships is we have the whites of the eyes. Notice that most animals don't. But with the human eye, there's more white than there is color, which actually enables you to detect mutual gaze going on from, say, 100 feet away. You can see a human that's 100 feet away, and you can tell whether they're looking at you or not. But if a dog is 100 feet away from you, you really can't tell, just because you don't get enough information from making eye contact with them. But also, if you've got a pet dog, they're rather strongly motivated to let you know they're making eye contact with you. And so that kind of explains why a dog will run towards you, so that you can actually get that eye contact going, whereas from 100 feet away that can't happen, but with humans it can. Which gets me back to the text, the way of a man with a maiden, okay? Here's a man, he looks at a maiden 100 feet away, he can tell whether or not that maiden is interested in him just by looking at her eyes. And without the whites, he wouldn't be able to do that. So the whites of the eye, I think, are actually part of what's going on here. And why is it that the whites of the eye are unique to human beings? We don't see that in other species. We do see it in the human species. And there's actually research making the point that because of the whites of the eyes, we human beings are able, in a huge crowd of people, to actually have a relationship at a distance. That wouldn't be possible otherwise. I mean, think of social situations you've had where they have, quote, a mixer at work, and 300 people in a large room, and there's noise, and you're trying to make contact with one another, the whites of the eyes is a real help. So, something to think about when you've got to go to one of these business meetings and make contact with people, yes.
Well, I was just thinking that falling water in general does produce negative ions. That's true even in rainstorms. And negative ions do have a beneficial effect for human physiology.
Right. Although I remember my sons when they were like 7 and 10 years of age, and we would be taking them to these wonderful scenic places, and they said, Dad, you can get the same effect by going to your sink and putting some rocks in the sink and turning the tap on. But when they got a little bit older, they realized, hey, you know, this really is a wonderful experience to go to a waterfall. But so, hey, we got to train our children a little bit, so... Yes.
There was a beautiful movie called Hachi with Richard Gere about the connection that he had with his dog. I highly recommend it. But why is it that in this movie, the dog could travel, you hear of dogs, if they're moved away, they can travel 100 miles and go back to where they lived. What is that ability of a dog, what gives the dog the ability, if it's lost, to find its way back home like that?
I don't know. I mean, there have been experiments done with birds and turtles, for example, where they say that they actually have a compass in their brain that actually enables them to, even though they're, you know, 1,500 miles away from their birthplace, they can find their way back.
It's fascinating, because in this movie, he died. I mean, actually, oh, God, well, there's more to it. You gotta watch it. But he would still come every day to the same spot where he would get off the train to meet him.
Oh, yeah.
And it was just like, and then he would just sit there waiting for him. And years went by, he's still waiting for his master. And the loyalty that that dog has teaches humans the unconditional love that animals give us. That is the, it's almost, I think, animals are God's gift, like angels, to teach us to love one another. And that loyalty and commitment is that animals teach us. It's beautiful.
It is beautiful, and I think it's designed to show us what kind of relationship God wants with us.
Yeah.
I mean, again, my book on Job, I made the point that, you know, God designed these animals to bond with us, to serve and please us, and we're a higher species. Doesn't that tell us something about how we're designed? That we're designed likewise to bond with a higher being and to serve and please that higher being, and in that sense, these animals can teach us how we can develop a relationship with God. But based on this paper and what I see here in Proverbs 30, maybe there's something in there where they're actually designed also to teach us how to relate to one another, how to form relationships with one another. And therefore, I think it is positive, say, as we're raising our children, to let them have these kinds of relationships with these animals. And by the way, I notice with our boys is like they wanted every kind of imaginable pet. And I thank God for Kathy that she actually tolerated this, because when they were really young, they wanted pet insects, they wanted pet reptiles and pet amphibians. They also had pet rocks, but that didn't last long. but what's interesting, as they went through this phase, they realized that there's a big difference between amphibians, reptiles, and insects, and birds and mammals. And so by the time they got to be about 10 years of age, the snakes were gone, the frogs were gone, various lizards were gone, the spiders were gone. I couldn't believe Kathy actually tolerated tarantulas, but she did. But they were gone. And then our sons recognized the difference that, with the birds and mammals, you can have a relationship with them. You can bond with them, and they'll bond with you, and they'll serve and please you. But I'm just suggesting, I think it's important in terms of preparing our children for marriage to let them have those kinds of experiences. Yes.
What is your opinion on the fact that this bond with a dog might go into a metaphysical relation where the dog knows when the owner comes from work, even at different times, where it's expected to be a form of telepathy? And there are some research done where it shows like a 60% proof that that bond exists without even having the connection, the visual connection, where the dog goes to the place where he looks at.
Well, I think clearly dogs have senses in many respects that are far superior to ours. I mean, think of this, 40% of a dog's brain supports its nose, which explains why when you take a dog for a walk, it's not looking where it's going. It's not listening to where it's going. It's following its nose. And but they have a great better sense of hearing than we do. For example, the dog in our home knows the sound of every vehicle of every member of the family. He knows who's about to come to the door just by the sound of the car that's coming up the road. And also, dogs have a sense of timing. For example, you know, our dog it's basically our son Joel's dog. And that dog knows when Joel should be home from work. And if Joel is late, the dog starts getting stressed, because it says, hey, it's time for him to be home, and he's not home yet. So, And this is why, for example, I've always had the habit when I'm on the road, I'll actually have the pet be put on the phone just to help release the stress of the pet that I'm away from home. And by the way, it really works. I found with both the dogs and the cats that we've had, just simply letting them hear your voice over the phone, it releases their stress level. And they know, hey, you know, maybe my owner's actually going to come back. So, but I think it's, you know, we sell these animals short. They're able to form relationships with us in a way far beyond what we think is possible. And by the way, I think there's the extreme. I've run into a lot of people where they actually more strongly bond to their pet than they do to human beings. And I think what this text and this paper is telling us is God gave us these animals so we can more strongly bond with our fellow human beings and have a more loving relationship with our fellow human beings. But where it can be abused is we ignore our fellow human beings and we simply focus on the animals. And this is where I think Genesis 2 has some bearing, where, you know, Adam formed these amazing relationships with these animals. Keep in mind, he was not yet a sinner. And so the relationships he had with these animals would have been far more fulfilling and strong than the relationships we're able to develop. But what does the text say? God looked down at Adam and recognized he was alone. These animals couldn't fulfill. And so I think that's what's important is, yeah, we can have these bonded relationships with the animals, but realize God designed them so we can more strongly and powerfully bond with one another. Yes.
I can't believe I'm asking this question, but has anybody ever done an experiment where they've tried to get an insect to bond with them?
Well, my sons were convinced that these tarantulas were bonding with them because the tarantulas would actually crawl all over you and, you know, and they would actually pet the tarantula and the tarantula would tolerate it. And I was trying to explain to them that the tarantula really was wanting your body heat. And likewise, I noticed that with the reptiles, because we had some reptiles that would actually want to get close to our sons. And incidentally, I've had friends who we were backpacking, and they woke up and found a rattlesnake in their sleeping bag. That can be kind of scary, right?
Yeah.
Well, if that ever happens to you, just be really calm. Let the rattlesnake get the body heat that it wants, and it will crawl out of your bag. So that's why it's there. I'm not sure I could be all that calm. But that's really what the reptiles, you know, they're cold-blooded. And in order for them to get the activity level they need to be able to hunt, they need some body warmth, which explains why snakes, for example, and lizards, will bake themselves on a rock that's exposed to the sun. They're trying to elevate their body temperature to a point where they can engage in the higher level activity that they're going to need to engage in. But also explains why reptiles will, quote, behave in a way where you think, hey, you know, this really is a pet. You know, they just want to get on you so that they can get the body heat. So, you know, and they'll snuggle up on you, but it's really all about body heat. By the way, it took our sons quite a while to realize the difference between a relationship they could have with a reptile and the relationship they could have with birds and mammals. And the thing they learned, for example, we had this 5-foot-long iguana, beautiful animal. But what our sons learned was, and by the way, it was a prank. One of our relatives gave us the iguana when it was little, and it's like, oh boy. And so we were tempted to prank him back, but we didn't. But what we noticed is that this iguana would not tolerate other animals in the house. It went after all the rest of our pets. And that's when they have been told, hey, if you want to have a pet iguana, make sure it's the only pet in the house.
And why?
Why? Because there's actually some research that it may actually... After all, a few of the higher reptiles are capable of forming emotional bonds with human beings. And the research is out as whether that applies to an iguana. But with people who have had a pet iguana, the iguana will actually come to them every day. Maybe again it's just for the body heat. They don't know. You can make pets out of crocodiles and alligators. Not easily, but it can be done. And so, yeah, you first. Well, people who've successfully bonded to their pet alligator or crocodile, it's a huge investment of time. You've got to get that crocodile alligator at the moment it comes out of the egg and spend time with them on a daily basis, and you don't want to miss a day. It's very easy for the alligator or the crocodile to lose that bond. But if you're willing to put the effort into it, the bond can be done. And by the way, I think that shows up in the book of Job, where Job basically makes the point, we human beings have been able to tame all of these different nephesh animals, including even the behemoth and the leviathan. And I believe the leviathan is a reference to the crocodile slash alligator. We can do that. But then the book of Job ends by saying, there's one nephesh animal you can't tame. You cannot bring humility to a proud human being. Just like it takes a higher species to tame these lower species, likewise it takes a higher being to tame us. So unless they're willing to come to God to be tamed by Him, we're not going to make it. We can't tame one another. Yes?
Have you had your own Tarzan experiences with, say, great apes or whatever?
No, I never have. My father, however, when he was a young man, had a pet monkey.
Yeah?
And he said it was a wonderful pet, but also required a lot of maintenance. Because the problem with the apes is they can make a big mess in a very short period of time. And they're very smart, and they can get into a lot of trouble. So yeah, there's a movie out called The Monkey Kingdom. If you go see it, you'll get an idea of the destructive power of the apes. There's a scene in that movie where it shows these monkeys disrupting a birthday party. Because, you know, the children are outside and the monkeys find what's inside, the cake and everything is there. And by the time the owners come in, the place is, you're looking at several hours of work to clean up from the rampage of the monkeys. So, and by the way, this is a problem for medical research. Monkeys are a lot more difficult to manage than, say, mice and rats. Now, you had a comment. Go ahead.
In the old days, they used to have these flea circuses. How can you dress and tame a flea? I couldn't ever understand this.
Well, okay. And you know, this is something that people, you know, because we human beings are powerfully motivated to try to tame all these different creatures. And just like my sons, they tried to tame these non-nephesh animals. Other people have done that too. And yeah, a flea circus is basically somebody simply taking advantage of the instincts of the flea. The flea is going to do what it wants to do independent of any training. You can't train the fleas, but you can actually put them in an environment where they'll do the normal flea thing. So yeah, you want to get them to jump, they're good at jumping. So, and if you actually put them in a situation where they can only jump in one direction, they'll do that. And incidentally, there's, you know, we tend to anthropomorphize. So you may have seen these documentaries where you've got a horse that does math or a dog that does math. And they're saying, wow, you know, these non-human animals have symbolic capability. Incidentally, this was a debate in the recent scientific literature where people are trying to claim that these animals had symbolic capabilities just like us human beings. But when you actually unpackage the study, what you got is a horse, for example, the owner says, okay, what's 3 plus 4? And the horse will stomp 7 times. Okay, but what they've discovered is the horse is actually watching the owner very carefully. And so the owner's going, and then stop, and the horse stops. And, you know, I did it very obviously, but this is actually what happens, is that the owner can, quote, train the horse or the dog to, quote, do certain math problems, and they begin by giving very obvious spatial clues. Then they make the clues more and more subtle, so the bystanders can't see the clues. But the horse can see the clues, the dog can see the clue, and, quote, get the answer right. So it's not that the horse knows math or the dog knows math, it's you've got this incredibly strong relationship between the owner and the animal where it looks like they're able to do mathematical problems. They can't. And the way they've been able to show that is you take the owner away and put somebody else in, and the horse and the dog can't do the math at all. So that's how they're able to pick it. You can actually see the clues. Now, you had a comment. Yeah.
Well, I was just commenting that the behavior of your iguana is very common with animals that bond. I have tame birds. I have to keep my birds all separate because they're bonded to me and they will not tolerate each other. I one case, when I got my crow, I put him in my he's so big, he can't fly. The pigeon will leave him alone. Within 20 minutes, the pigeon figured out the crow couldn't fly. The pigeon's down there chasing this bird three times his size around picking on him, you know? And so pretty much all my pets are bonded to me and they don't really tolerate others. Controversy on birds, if you have two birds, you have two birds. If you have one bird, you have a pet that will bond to you. So these relationships are very complex.
Now, Dave, what I'd like to do is get Barbara to come here and testify of how your relationships with all these pets actually stimulates the oxytocin that enhances the relationship between you and Barbara. I think that'd be relevant to this text we're studying here.
That's probably why I'm a scout leader for 60 boys also.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, right. Well, this is an ongoing debate in the scientific literature. Are we humans really exceptional in terms of our symbolic capability? And yeah, where you do see animals that have the appearance of symbolic capability, like say with a horse that can do math or an elephant that can draw a symbol, you need the human bond to make it happen. And, you know, there's this famous account where there's this gorilla that has a language of over 200 words.
Right.
It took 20 years of bonding with a human being for that capability to be drawn out. Or, for example, a parrot that develops a large vocabulary. That's a direct result of a strong, long-lasting bond between the human and the parrot. But can the parrot actually communicate in a paragraph or a sentence? No, they can't. They simply can mimic the words that they were taught in this relationship they had with a human being. And the thing we notice with human beings is they don't need that 20-year-long period of training to get something that looks like symbolic capability. They get it very quickly. I mean, that's one thing you notice with your children. They're able to gain symbolic capability literally within months after they're born. I mean, it happens very quickly. You don't see that in non-human animals. As I've mentioned before here in the class, no matter how much you train an elephant, a dog, or a horse, or a dolphin, they can't figure out what a stop sign is. I mean, it's a very simple symbol, stop sign, or railroad crossing. You know, very simple symbols, they can't figure it out. Or they can't distinguish between different letters of the alphabet, or different numbers on a sign. By the way, there is one classic video that's out there which shows a dog being able to figure out what the numbers are. But again, what they were able to demonstrate, it's the human bond. The dog is kind of looking at the owner to figure out what number it should bark at when he gets, quote, the right answer. It really can't recognize the difference between a 4, a 3, and a 7 and know what it really means. That's something that is unique to human beings. And I actually argue it's a powerful piece of evidence that we human beings are specially created. Because the evolutionist is forced to conclude we gained that symbolic capability through naturalistic evolution, which means we should be able to see it in some form in non-human species. We don't see it in any form in non-human species, and we see it fully developed in human beings, even to the point where, quote, we can do tensor calculus. I mean, we don't see any mathematical capability, symbolic capability, any level for the animals. It's unique to human beings. Yes.
Well, apparently it's not that lack of symbolic capability is not due to a lack of pattern recognition, because I've seen some pretty dramatic demonstrations where a dog was able to go into another room remote from the owner and retrieve a toy that had a name out of hundreds to select from, and that they can make highly refined discriminations of different patterns, even though they don't have the ability to form a symbolic.
Right, you'll see an article by my colleague Fuzz Rana on our reasons.org website where he basically describes this debate about whether or not we human beings are unique and exceptional in our symbolic capability. And so the problem is you've got scientists who look at the vocalization of non-human animals and the communication ability of non-human animals, and they conflate that with symbolic capability. And Fuzz's whole point in writing that article is there's an enormous difference between the ability to vocalize, the ability to communicate, and actually having symbolic capability. So, yeah, animals definitely can communicate with one another. They can communicate with us. I mean, the pets in our home are very good at telling us what they need and what time they need it. They seem to know where all the treats are. I mean, you'll see them actually pointing at the drawer where they're able to communicate. But there's no symbolic capability. So, yes.
Being autistic, did you, like as a baby, could you, and you say you didn't relate as a woman, you know, with your oxytocin, maybe, do somebody who's on that realm, can you not have that? Do you have that eye contact or don't you? I don't know.
Well, okay, I've got what's called Asperger's syndrome, so that's part of the autistic spectrum. And by the way, every autistic person is different from every other autistic person, so there's no generalizations you can make. But yeah, when I was growing up, I would not look people in the eye. That was interesting. I would look pets in the eye, but not humans in the eye. And the reason why is when I looked humans in the eye, I couldn't figure out what they were communicating. Because humans are far more complex than animals. And so it was just too risky for me to engage in that because I would draw the wrong conclusions and get myself into trouble. So the safest thing to do is to stare at the floor. And that was what's kind of interesting is that when I first met Kathy, she says, you never look anybody in the eye. You always just stare at the floor. And so she began to train me at how to actually make eye contact with human beings. But, so it's trainable. And that's what I tell people with children that are on the autistic spectrum, especially if they've got, some high function capability, like they're not mentally retarded. You can actually, through training, be able to gain some social capabilities. Now, it takes time. It took me decades. So it takes time. But just realizing that, you can work on it. And so, I had a hard time in school for the first, because my teachers would try to make me talk and I wouldn't talk. So, part of my story is I almost failed grade one, because the way you pass grade one is you do these math problems. Part of my autistic idea is I didn't have fine motor skills. As a child, I couldn't hold a pencil and make it do what I wanted it to do. So I couldn't prove that I could do the math problems. I could do them in my head, but I couldn't show people I could do them. And I couldn't prove I could read because you had to stand up in front of the class and read. And, talking was just very scary for me, so I wouldn't talk. Fortunately, I was transferred from one school to another school. So the last 6 weeks of grade one, I was in a brand new school. And there was a teacher there who held me after class and said, "You don't have to talk. You don't have to look at me. All you got to do is nod your head or shake your head as I ask you questions about these books." And she figured out that I'd read a couple of dozen books. So she said, "I'm going to pass you into grade two." So, and then at the end of the year, they're reading the names of all the people that were being passed into grade two, read in order, top student, next student. I was the last student that was passed into grade two. So that didn't give me a lot of confidence for going into grade two. But what I found out 30 years after that was that grade one teacher was a Christian. And she saw something in me because she said, "I could see you were frustrated. It was obvious that you were very frustrated." And so I said, "I figured there was something going on there. So that's why I held you after class." But she also told me that from that day onward, she prayed for me. So all the years growing up, there was a Christian praying for me I knew nothing about. So
how old were you when you were first diagnosed with
SPEC? I didn't realize that I was on the spectrum until about a decade ago.
Only 10 years?
Well, I mean, as growing up, I just realized I had certain handicaps that I had to work on. So, for example, when I was 6 years of age, I said, if I'm going to make it in school, I got to learn how to hold a pencil. And my parents were really, you know, freaked out, because I would go home from school and spend 3 hours trying to make things happen with my hand. And they thought I was kind of, you know, what's the term?
Mentally
compulsive. So, but by grade two, by the middle of grade two, I could actually make letters and numbers. So that really helped me get out of grade two. And by the way, I went into grade two, and they put me in the last chair. They don't do this in schools anymore because they're so worried about your self-image. But in the Canadian public school system, where you sat in the classroom was based on your academic rank. So there was the first chair, the second chair, the third chair. I was in chair number 38. So, but I realize I do not want to be in the 38th chair by the time I'm finished with grade two. So I began as I got to force myself to talk. And even though it was scary, I started talking to people. And I started figuring out how to hold a pencil. By the end of grade two, I was in the first chair. So, but just because I said, hey, I got to start fixing things. And I kind of did that. You know, and Kathy told me I need to look people in the eye. I said, okay, that's what I need to do. I'll start doing it. Even if it's scary, I'll try it and see what happens. Worst thing that can happen is somebody will punch me in the nose. So if that's what's got to be done to live a normal life, I'll do it. So, and that's really, I think, what we need to do. And by the way, I'm really glad that they didn't put me in a special school. Today, that's what often happens when you're on the spectrum. They put you in a special school. And what happens is the child stops being motivated to try to learn how to adapt to neurotypical people, and that can be a problem. So I'm glad that never happened. So, yes.
Do you think that part of this first and second grade thing, let me paraphrase it, being a boy named Sue, helped you concentrate and focus on physics that much more?
Well, my sisters, I'm the oldest of the siblings in my family. My sisters told me I changed dramatically when I got exposed to a book. Because, you know, my family was really poor. We had no books in the home. But when I started going to school, books. And it said, they claim I changed overnight once I started reading books. Because now I could relate in a way that was safe. I didn't have to read people's emotions or figure out what they were communicating with their eyes. I just had to read the symbols in the book. And so that's part of my story. At age 7, I was reading 5 books on physics and astronomy per week. So now, if I wasn't on the spectrum, that probably wouldn't have happened. I mean, if I was, quote, normal, I don't think that would have happened. And by the way, I'm convinced the human population needs a few people like me. Not a lot. But a few. And I'm also convinced what really helps these people that are on the spectrum is animals. Mm-hmm. I can tell you it was animal relationships I had that really helped me form relationships with humans. And I think that's what this paper is all about. It's saying this even works for normal people. It especially works for people that are on the spectrum, but it works for normal people as well. And I can see that my time is up because Dave is standing there. And I missed another discovery I was going to communicate with you. I'll talk about that next week. But let's bow. Father in heaven, we want to thank you, Lord, for this special text in Proverbs 30. Thank you, too, for these research studies that are being done. Thank you, Lord, that our scientific community is actually rediscovering science that's been ignored literally for decades, even centuries. These amazing animals that you created for us to teach us things about ourselves, about these animals, about relationships we can have with our fellow man, but also, most importantly, we can develop a relationship with you. So, Father, I do pray that thanks to this new research, we would learn lessons. Thanks to what we see here in the text, we would learn lessons that would help us to be more successful in relating to one another, and particularly in building stronger marriages and stronger families. Pray, too, Father, we will use this content that we see and the Proverbs 30 as a tool to bring people to faith in Jesus Christ. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Amen.